Picture it. You are standing in this massive palatial home in 1920s Paris.
Right, the height of the Roaring Twenties.
Exactly. And the walls around you are literally covered in platinum wallpaper.
Just wow.
Yeah, and you go to sit down, and the chair is upholstered in real zebra skin.
Which is just an insane visual.
It really is. And outside, there's this rumor circulating among all the guests that the guy throwing this party just rented an entire palace in Venice
Oh, right.
for $4,000 a month, which, you know, today is roughly the equivalent of buying a small island.
Easily.
And he didn't just rent the palace, he hired 50 gondoliers to act as his personal footmen.
It sounds less like a real life and more like, I don't know, a carefully constructed movie set, like a total
Yeah.
fantasy of endless wealth and sophistication.
Yes, exactly. But the architect of this champagne-soaked universe, the guy who defined what it meant to be high society elite, was actually born on a farm in Peru, Indiana.
Which is quite the leap.
A massive leap. So today, we are taking a deep dive into the life and career of American composer and songwriter Cole Porter.
Right.
And the mission for this deep dive is to figure out how a boy from the rural Midwest transformed himself into the ultimate symbol of sophisticated urbane wit.
Because there's a lot hiding behind that image.
Oh, for sure. Because when you strip away the platinum wallpaper, what you find is that his sparkling, like completely effortless music actually masked a life of incredibly complex secrets and eventually profound physical agony.
Yeah, I mean, we all know the catchy tunes, the standards that have been covered by everyone from Ella Fitzgerald to Lady Gaga.
Oh, absolutely iconic songs.
Right, but to truly understand the man who revolutionized the American songbook, we really have to look past the top hat and tails.
We do.
What's fascinating here is the sheer scale of the contradictions in Porter's life. He was a man who craved the spotlight, but hid his true self entirely.
Yeah.
A man who wrote the most effervescent music of the 20th century while enduring just unimaginable perpetual pain.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because his origins are genuinely the last thing you would expect.
They really are.
If you think of Cole Porter, you immediately think of Manhattan penthouses.
Sure, cocktail parties, high society.
Exactly. You do not think of Peru, Indiana in 1891. But that is where he was born, right into a family with this massive, looming power dynamic.
Yeah, his grandfather was a huge figure.
J.O. Cole, he was literally known as the richest man in Indiana. He made
Wow.
this huge fortune in the gold rush and then compounded it in timber and coal. He was your classic, tough-as-nails, commanding patriarch.
And sitting completely opposite to that rugged patriarch is Porter's mother, Kate.
Right.
She recognized his musical talent incredibly early. And she didn't just nurture it, she ruthlessly managed it.
She really did.
She had him on the violin at age 6, the piano at 8. And with her help, he was writing his first operetta by the time he was 10.
And she wasn't just a supportive parent, she was practically his
Yeah,
publicist.
she was very savvy.
She actively falsified his recorded birth year. She changed it from 1891 to 1893 just to make him appear to be, you know, a younger, more impressive musical prodigy to the public.
Which is a brilliant detail.
Isn't it?
Because it establishes a psychological baseline for Porter's entire life. This idea that reality is malleable.
Yes,
If
exactly.
the facts of your life don't fit the narrative you want to project to the world, you just change the
You
facts.
just rewrite them.
Right. But while his mother is carefully crafting this musical genius persona, the billionaire grandfather has an entirely different demand.
Oh, yeah, he is not having it.
No. J.O. Cole dictates that his grandson must become a lawyer. That was the only acceptable, serious path for the heir to the Cole fortune.
So off he goes to Worcester Academy in Massachusetts and then to Yale.
Yep.
But at Yale, Porter doesn't exactly hunker down in the law library. He becomes the absolute center of gravity for the campus social
He
scene.
brings his own piano, right?
He brings an upright piano with him. He sings in the Whiffenpoofs, joins the Glee Club, and writes an astonishing 300 songs while he is an undergrad.
Which is just a crazy volume of work. And he isn't just writing polite parlor music either.
No.
He writes the Yale football fight songs, Bulldog and Bingo Eli Yale.
Which are still played at Yale games today.
It's amazing.
Like, next time you watch a college football game and hear a marching band blaring, just think about the fact that the guy who wrote the most sophisticated martini-sipping cabaret songs of the
It's
1930s
the height of elegance.
also wrote the rowdy anthems that college kids are screaming a century later.
It really highlights his incredible adaptability. He figured out very quickly that music was his ultimate social currency.
Oh, absolutely.
It was how he gained entry, how he entertained, and how he made himself indispensable to whatever room he was in.
But he still has the grandfather breathing down his neck, so he dutifully enrolls in Harvard Law School.
For a minute, anyway.
Right. He only lasts a short time before the dean of the law school basically pulls him aside and says, "You are not meant to be a lawyer."
A very observant dean.
Yeah. So Porter secretly switches to the Harvard Music Department.
And his mom knows.
His mom is completely in on it. She gives him her blessing, but they keep it a total secret from the grandfather.
Wow.
It's like a modern tech heir dropping out of Stanford Business School to become an underground DJ, but keeping it a complete secret from the billionaire patriarch who is actually footing the bill.
It's a massive risk.
Yeah.
You know, you are defying the source of your entire family's wealth and status.
Yeah.
And initially, the gamble fails completely.
It goes so badly.
Like 1916, Porter finally gets his first Broadway show, a comic opera called See America First.
Mm.
And it is a spectacular flop.
Just a disaster.
It closes in 2 weeks.
Which has to be a crushing blow. I mean, you've staked your entire identity on this rebellion against your grandfather. You step out onto the biggest stage in New York and you just fall flat on your face.
So he flees.
Yeah.
The humiliation in New York, combined with the eruption of World War I, pushes Porter across the Atlantic to Europe.
Right.
And this geographical shift is what triggers his ultimate reinvention.
Okay.
He moves to Paris in 1917, initially to work with a relief organization. But immediately, we see that instinct to curate his own myth kick back in.
Right, because he starts telling everyone he joined the French Foreign Legion.
Yes.
He even has a portrait hanging in their museum in Aubagne to this day.
Which is wild.
It is. But modern biographers have seriously disputed the exact nature of his military service or if he was ever actually in the Legion at all.
Yeah, the timeline is very murky.
And he also went around claiming he carried a specially constructed portable piano on his back to entertain troops in the trenches.
Which is an incredibly cinematic visual.
But practically speaking, a backpack piano in a muddy World War I trench, it sounds absurd.
Completely absurd. But true or not, it didn't really matter. It built the mystique. It was part of the armor he was creating.
Mm.
And he stays in Paris after the war, which is when he starts living that jaw-dropping life of luxury we talked about at the beginning.
The zebra chairs.
Exactly. The zebra chairs, the rented Venetian palaces, hiring the entire ballet's roses just to entertain his friends at a private party.
And this brings us to Linda Lee Thomas.
Yes.
In 1918, he meets this wealthy divorcee from Kentucky. She's 8 years older than him, extraordinarily well-connected socially, and they marry in 1919.
Right.
Now, looking at this from the outside, Porter was homosexual, and he engaged in frequent affairs throughout his life.
Yes, he did.
So a cynic might look at this marriage and assume it was just a cold, calculated transaction. He gets a respectable cover story. She gets a companion. Was it really just a business arrangement?
Well, it's easy to view it through that modern, cynical lens, but that ignores the reality of the era.
Okay.
Homosexuality in the 1920s wasn't just frowned upon. It was actively dangerous.
Right, of course.
Marrying Linda gave Porter an unassailable, respectable heterosexual front in a deeply intolerant society.
That makes sense.
But for Linda, who had barely escaped a notoriously abusive first husband, Porter offered something incredibly rare. A gentle, amusing, brilliant partner who made her feel safe.
Oh, wow.
They shared a genuine love of travel and culture. The historical consensus is very clear that they were deeply, profoundly devoted to each other until the day she died.
She really was his protector. And she pushed him artistically, too, when he was just kind of floating through high society.
She definitely did.
With her encouragement, he wrote a ballet in 1923 called Within the Quota. It was the satirical piece about an immigrant coming to America.
Right.
And what's mind-blowing here is that this is one of the earliest symphonic jazz-based compositions ever written. It actually predates George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue by 4 months.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you start to realize that this entire period in Europe, the lavish parties, the endless social calendar, the platinum wallpaper, right. It wasn't just Porter stalling his career. He was doing immersive field research.
Oh, that is a great way to put it.
He was soaking up the dialogue, the cynical attitudes, and the specific cadence of the upper crust. He was living inside the exotic settings that would eventually populate his lyrics.
Yeah.
He needed to embody that life entirely so he could write about it later mm-hmm. with absolute effortless authenticity.
He was building his vocabulary.
Exactly.
But the clock is ticking, the 20s are roaring along, and he's still mostly known as a wealthy playboy who writes clever songs for his friends at private parties.
Yeah, he's not famous yet.
He actually almost gives up songwriting entirely. But finally, at age 37, the breakthrough happens.
Better late than never.
Right. In 1928, he is hired to write the score for a Broadway musical called Paris. And this show features his first monumental hit, Let's Do It, Let's Fall in Love.
Such a classic.
And suddenly, the floodgates open.
To understand the explosion of his career from that point on, we have to look at the mechanics of a Cole Porter song.
Okay, let's do it.
Broadway at the time was largely defined by the collaborative machine. You had the composer and the lyricist, Rodgers and Hammerstein, the Gershwin brothers, Lerner and Lowe.
Always a duo.
Right.
Yeah.
But Porter was a one-man monopoly over his art. He wrote both the music and the lyrics.
Which gave him absolute granular control over how the words hit the melody.
Yes.
And his lyrical style was just unmatched. He was highly educated, and he loved showing it off. He was the absolute master of the Liszt song.
Oh, the Liszt songs are brilliant.
Think of You're the Top, where he's just rattling off these brilliant rhyming comparisons. You're the Top, You're the Colosseum, You're the Talk, You're the Louvre Museum.
And what made those Liszt songs so revolutionary wasn't just the clever rhyming, it was the juxtaposition.
Yeah, so.
Well, he was the first to realize that taking a timeless, highbrow piece of classical art like the Louvre and rhyming it with temporary modern pop culture or modern slang was inherently funny.
Oh, yeah.
It leveled the social playing field within the span of a single musical phrase.
He could be so witty and cynical, but then pivot and write these deeply, intensely sincere ballads that just rip your heart out.
Night and day.
Night and day, exactly. Yeah. I've got you under my skin.
And he was incredibly risque, too.
Oh, very much so.
He didn't hide behind double entendres. He often used single entendres.
He just said it.
He just said it. In 1930, he wrote a song for the show The New Yorkers called Love for Sale.
Right.
It was written explicitly from the perspective of a streetwalker. The lyrics were considered so scandalous that the song was actually banned from radio play.
Which, of course, only made it a massive jazz standard anyway.
Naturally, everyone wanted to hear the band song.
Exactly. And musically, he was just as boundary pushing. He utilized heavy chromaticism.
Okay, we hear chromaticism thrown around in music theory all the time. But what does that actually mean for the person sitting in the audience listening to the song?
Well, think of a standard nursery rhyme or a basic song.
Like Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star? Sure. They usually jump cleanly from one whole note to another in a major key. It feels safe, predictable.
Right.
Chromaticism doesn't do that. It uses the half steps. Think of the black keys on the piano, essentially sliding through the notes in between.
Oh, okay.
Neurologically, it creates oral tension. It makes the listener feel slightly off balance. It feels slippery, a little dangerous.
Which perfectly mirrored the seductive themes of his lyrics.
Exactly.
He also loved these Mediterranean minor keys. There's this amazing detail where he actually told his peer, Richard Rodgers, that his secret to success was that he wanted to write Jewish tunes.
Right.
He was tapping into that deep minor key emotive tradition to give his melodies this intense feeling of yearning.
He was also a pioneer in bringing global rhythms to Broadway.
Yeah.
Because of his vast travels with Linda, he brought international sounds back to New York. The Begin was famously inspired by a native dance he saw in the Dutch East Indies. He frequently used Latin American and Middle Eastern rhythms, creating a sonic landscape that felt wildly exotic to an American audience.
And by 1934, he hits the absolute stratosphere with the show Anything Goes.
A masterpiece.
He writes it specifically for Ethel Merman's big, brassy voice, and the show is just a juggernaut.
Huge success.
But here's where it gets really interesting. We usually think of musicals as needing songs that drive the plot forward.
Right, that is the golden rule of musical theater.
Yes. But Porter supposedly viewed the plot of a musical as just a, quote, convenient clothesline on which to hang his songs.
He didn't really care.
He didn't care about the narrative arc at all. So is that why his music survives so well, completely out of context today?
It is precisely why.
Yeah?
Because he wasn't intricately weaving his songs into the specific dialogue and character arcs of Act One or Act Two. The songs had to stand entirely on their own.
Oh, that makes total sense.
They functioned as miniature, self-contained stories. When you listen to a Porter song, The emotion, the setting, the conflict, it's all baked into the 3-minute track.
You don't need the script.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why jazz singers and pop stars could lift his songs right out of the theater and make them massive, standalone hits on the radio.
So he's on top of the world. He's the king of Broadway. He's writing for Hollywood. He's living in the Waldorf Towers. It is the late 1930s.
The peak of his career.
Yeah. And then tragedy strikes in a way that's just horrifying to even think about.
It really is.
It's October 1937. Porter is at a writing club in New York. The horse he is riding, Spooks, rears up and literally falls, rolling directly over Porter and absolutely crushing both of his legs.
The physical damage was catastrophic.
Awful.
The doctors initially told Linda and his mother that his right leg would absolutely have to be amputated, and possibly the left one as well.
But Porter flatly refused.
He did. And Linda, who rushed back from Paris the moment she heard, backed his refusal.
What follows is an absolute nightmare of medical interventions. Yeah.
He undergoes 34 operations. And from that day in 1937 until his death in 1964, he lives in constant, severe, agonizing pain.
He's relentless.
His legs are essentially destroyed, leaving him substantially crippled.
This raises an important question, perhaps the most profound question about Porter's legacy.
What's that?
How do we reconcile the dichotomy of the artist versus the art? Because he is in the hospital for 7 months, wrapped in traction, enduring perpetual agony.
Right.
And yet, the music he writes during this period is still the lightest, most sparkling, effervescent, witty music of the 20th century.
It's unbelievable.
He is writing upbeat, joyful songs like Well, Did You, Eva, and Friendship. There is not a single trace of self-pity, not a hint of the hospital room in those notes.
Wait, hold on. As a human being, if you are undergoing 34 surgeries and your legs are crushed, your art is going to get dark.
It seems inevitable.
Right. It's inevitable that your mental state bleeds into your work. How is it neurologically or psychologically possible that not a single drop of that agony made it into his sheet music? Because for Porter, music was no longer just a career or a social tool to entertain high society. It had become a literal psychological survival mechanism.
Oh, wow.
Think of it like a cognitive painkiller.
A cognitive painkiller.
Yeah. Just as a runner's high uses endorphins to mask the pain of a marathon, Porter used the intense mathematical focus required to compose complex counterpoint and intricate rhyme schemes to literally block the pain signals from reaching his conscious mind.
That is incredible.
The absolute concentration required to write a Cole Porter song was the only thing that provided relief from the physical torture of his body.
It's staggering resilience. But it wasn't a smooth path either.
No.
In the 1940s, the pain is relentless, and he suffers a string of Broadway flops. The critics start circling.
They'd be so cruel.
They write that he's washed up, that his best days are behind him, that the era has completely passed him by.
Which only sets the stage for one of the greatest second acts in theater history.
Yeah.
In 1948, against all odds and fighting through chronic pain, Porter stages a massive comeback with the musical Kiss Me, Kate.
And it doesn't just do well, it shatters expectations.
It was huge.
It runs for 1,077 performances in New York. The score is unbelievable. Another opening, another show, So In Love, Too Darn Hot.
Iconic songs.
And when the very first Tony Awards are ever held, Kiss Me, Kate wins Best Musical, and Porter wins for Best Composer and Lyricist, it is a total, undeniable triumph.
He proved every single critic wrong.
He sure did.
He continued to have hits well into the 1950s, shows like Can Can and Silk Stockings and film scores like High Society.
Right.
But the physical toll of his injuries was compounding. His wife Linda died in 1954, which removed his greatest source of safety and support.
Yeah, that had to be devastating.
And by 1958, the injuries to his right leg had caused a series of severe recurring ulcers. Finally, after fighting it for over 20 years, the leg had to be amputated.
His friend, the playwright Noel Coward, actually visited him in the hospital after the amputation.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Coward wrote in his diary that the lines of ceaseless pain were finally wiped from Porter's face. Coward thought this relief from the pain would actually cheer Porter up and revitalize his work.
But the exact opposite happened.
Completely the opposite.
After the amputation, Cole Porter never wrote another song.
Not a single one.
It seems that the loss of the leg, perhaps combined with the immense grief of losing Linda, finally extinguished that spark.
Yeah.
The painkiller was no longer needed, or perhaps the psychological toll was simply too great.
He spent the last 6 years of his life in relative seclusion at the Waldorf Towers, surrounded by all the memorabilia of his extraordinary life, until he passed away from kidney failure in 1964.
It's a quiet end to such a loud life.
It is. So what does this all mean for you, the person listening right now?
It's a great question.
When you look at his entire life, the thread that pulls everything together is the concept of absolute control over your own narrative. Cole Porter was a master curator of reality. It started with his mother faking his birth year, and he spent the rest of his life perfecting the art of the facade.
Right. He hid his rural Indiana roots behind a transatlantic accent and Venetian palaces.
He navigated the dangers of his sexuality by building a beautiful, unconventional marriage that provided an ironclad shield.
He did.
And most stunningly, he hid absolute, agonizing physical pain behind the most elegant, joyous, toe-tapping art imaginable. He utterly refused to let the world see him suffer, so he gave them champagne and chromaticism instead.
He essentially authored his own reality.
Yeah.
And what is truly remarkable is that his autonomy over his legacy extended even past his death.
Oh, this part is fascinating.
There is a detail in his legal will. Porter explicitly stated that any of his songs could be taken and used in any of his other shows in the future.
Wow.
He officially, legally detached his art from its original context.
Which leaves us with a lingering thought to ponder. If a creator intentionally divorces their art so completely from the specific story it was originally written for, does that art really belong to the creator anymore?
Or does it belong entirely to the audience?
Right. Porter built that platinum wallpapered zebra skin facade so perfectly that the music outgrew the man who wrote it.
It really did.
It no longer belongs to the man suffering in the hospital bed. It belongs entirely to anyone listening who needs a little sophistication, a little wit, or a little escape to soundtrack their own lives.
It is the ultimate gift from an artist. He suffered the reality so we could live in the illusion.
It's beautiful. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us today. Until next time.